Welcome to Banfield. It is the case that captivated America for months. And now, almost 5 months after Gabby Petito was killed in Wyoming, her family may finally be getting some answers from law enforcement. Gabby's parents met with FBI agents in Tampa today for more than 8 hours. The very same day that Steve Bertolino, the attorney for Brian Laundrie's family, said the two families had reached a deal over property that Gabby and Brian had left behind. Brian Laundrie was the only suspect in Gabby Petito's death, but his remains were found in a Florida nature reserve in October before he could ever be charged. Authorities have ruled that he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. News Nation's Brian Enten is live for us in Florida tonight. Brian, 8.5 hours is a very, very long time to be in the Tampa FBI building. Do you know anything more about what was going on all that time?
Well, we know that this was a secret meeting. The FBI right now not commenting on exactly what happened, but it was a long time, 8.5 hours. And it appears, Ashley, tonight that this investigation that has been going on behind the scenes by the FBI is finally starting to wind down. We believe today that the Petitos were briefed on the investigation, all of the details that we haven't been able to uncover yet, that we know that the agents have been looking into, and that this report could be made public very, very soon. Another thing that likely happened today and why it took so long with them at the FBI headquarters in Tampa is, you remember the boxes and boxes of evidence that were taken from the Laundrie's home. Much of that stuff belonged to Gabby Petito. We know that Gabby's family wanted those items back, and it is very possible they were going through those items. Obviously, a very emotional process at the FBI office today.
I can't even imagine what that would be like, being reunited with the only thing left of your daughter. And I assume if that's what the Laundries were doing, they were probably pretty emotional, too, because they lost, Brian and all of this. So a question for you. We talked a lot about a storage locker. I remember that was one of the reasons Brian had said he was coming home from the trip that he and Gabby were taking, that he needed to get some things or move some things from a storage locker. Are these some of the things that we're probably talking about as well?
Yeah, likely items from the storage locker. The van is still in FBI custody in Tampa. And then again, all of those items from the garage that we saw them take away from the Laundrie house. We were able to get the Laundrie family attorney, Stephen Bertolino, today to confirm that after, quite a bit of negotiation, he did come to an agreement with the Petito family attorney about sort of who would get what. He wouldn't go into specifics, but he said the notebook, that infamous notebook that was found, has also been part of these ongoing negotiations.
Boy, I sure hope they'll release the contents. All right, so there are, obviously so many unanswered questions still. Hopefully the FBI will tell us some answers soon. But in the meantime, we narrowed it down to the top 10 unanswered questions that the public really deserves to know. Number one, why was Brian never labeled a suspect or arrested?
Yeah, that's a good point. He was never labeled a suspect. And the other interesting thing is people don't always realize this, but the FBI has never formally said that Brian Laundrie killed Gabby Petito. That's one of the reasons that we're so anxious for this final report to come out.
So that leads me to my second question. What happened to Gabby exactly? And what did Brian do right after?
I hate to go back and think about this because it was so sad, but we know that Gabby was strangled and killed in Wyoming. Brian drove her van back to Florida. But again, so many of the details that we know the FBI likely uncovered, we still don't know.
Lots of gaps. Okay. Why didn't the Laundries ever return Petito texts and phone calls?
Another very good question. We never got a good answer to that. The Laundries really still haven't spoken out at all publicly since all of this began. The only person who sort of communicates with the media still is their attorney.
Okay, this one might hold the answers to a lot of the questions above and below. What is in the notebook?
That's the million-dollar question. That's what we're all waiting to find out. Did the Petitos perhaps get to see inside that notebook today? It's possible. We know that it was wet when they found it in the reserve, but there was still things inside that were legible. So hopefully that'll be part of what we find out from the FBI.
Okay, and will anyone ever be charged, laundries or otherwise?
It's possible. I mean, that's been a big question. And it was interesting, Ashley, you might remember one of the more recent statements that Gabby's family put out through their attorney actually alluded to the fact that it was possible that there could still be more charges. We still don't know.
Okay. Why are the laundries continuing to remain silent?
Listen, you might have a better take on this than me, Ashley, but they're not talking at all. I mean, their attorney is very open to text messages with the media and sort of keeping us in the loop with information that he wants to share. But they haven't budged at all. I mean, they haven't said one word.
Well, I would say if there's open possibilities of federal charges, you don't want to go up against the feds. I'd stay silent, too. All right. How did the massive search teams miss Brian's remains and belongings that were just off the path?
I mean, I think we've all stayed up at night thinking about this one over the last several months. Very strange the way all of that went down after the massive search, that it was then the laundries who discovered the belongings and the remains. So I think that one we might never know the answer to.
Why did they go camping at such a bizarre time, just 6 days after Brian's return?
Again, and what did they talk about when they were on this camping trip? Did it come up? Where is your fiance, Gabby Petito? We still don't know. The laundry parents obviously would be able to answer that question. They haven't spoken. And sister Cassie also hasn't spoken since that initial interview.
So I'm going to skip over question nine because it's what did laundry tell his parents? And that answers it right there. We still don't know what they even talked about on that camping trip. So number 10, and maybe the most important one, was any motive ever uncovered?
No, and I think that is why this notebook is so crucial and why we all want to know what is inside the notebook. And perhaps the Petito family finally has some of the answers that they've been looking for tonight after that long meeting with the FBI.
All right, Brian Enten, who's been on the story since the beginning, thank you for doing this late hour reporting for us tonight. We appreciate it. Brian's going to continue to follow that story for us as well. So you've no doubt heard the expression police state. How about police town? That's how Brookside, Alabama is being described by people who live there and by people who just pass through there. The Brookside Police Department has been accused of harassing citizens, fabricating charges, using racist language and making up laws. All of it, critics say, to stack the charges and increase arrests, thereby forcing defendants to pay millions of dollars in fines and fees. Now, some of you might be thinking, hey, that's sour grapes, you know, from people who run afoul of the law. But the statistics seem to back it up. The Alabama news site AL.com has done a deep dive into policing in Brookside, and what they found is actually pretty shocking. Brookside seems to be building what could be described as a police empire. In 2018, when Mike Jones was hired as Brookside's chief of police, he, and only he, was the town's only full-time police officer. I mean, the town's only 1,200 people, right? That's like a high school, so it's not unreasonable to just have one cop. But since then, he's hired at least 8 other full-time officers and several part-timers, too. And 9 officers for a town that size is a lot. Don't take it from me. I'll give you the comparison. The average size of a police force in the United States is one officer for every 588 people. But Brookside is bucking that trend by at least 4 times that. One officer for every 144 residents. And there are some serious questions about whether Brookside really even needs all those extra officers. The town has just 6 miles of road. That's it. 6 miles to patrol, and it's got 1.5 miles of the interstate. Brookside does not even have a traffic light. And in 2018, when the town had just 1 full-time officer, it reported exactly 0 crimes. 0. But if you think the Brookside police are just sitting around and collecting free money, think again. They are actually working really, really hard. But that, according to the legal experts, is exactly why I'm telling you this story. Why it's a problem. The Brookside police are being accused of policing for profit. Since 2018, the police stops have soared. Between 2018 and 2020, Brookside made more misdemeanor arrests than it has residents. In 2018 alone, fines and forfeitures by the police brought in $71,000. That's, you know, a fair amount. But in 2020, it was $610,000. The police fines and forfeitures now represent almost 50% of all the town's revenue. And as more tickets brought in more money, the town began to spend much more, specifically on the police. In 2018, the budget for the police department was $79,000. But in 2020, it was almost seven times that, $524,000. And last year, the police budget soared to more than $646,000. 1,200 residents. Don't forget, it's the size of a high school. And it's not just the residents and people like me in the media who think that this is a problem. It's actually other law enforcement officers who think so, too. Brookside is located in Jefferson County. And the county's sheriff, Mark Petway, told AL.com, we get a lot of calls about Brookside quite regularly because they really go outside their jurisdiction to stop people. Most of the time, people get stopped. They're going to get a ticket. And they're saying they were nowhere near Brookside. And the Jefferson County DA, Danny Carr, he agrees. He says drivers can really get trapped by police in Brookside, adding, it's my understanding that a guy can go out there, and I mean, he can fall into a black hole. You know, we've had a lot of issues with Brookside. It seems like people have had enough there. Brookside's facing at least five different lawsuits about their policing habits, but the town's mayor does not seem to be too concerned. He says everybody's got a story, and 99% of them are lying. For his part, the police chief, Mike Jones, says he'd like to hire even more police officers and collect more fines, saying if I see a 600% increase, that's a failure. If you had more officers and more productivity, you'd have more. I think it could be more. So we've reached out to Mayor Mike Bryan and Chief Mike Jones about, you know, what's going on and appearing on the show and send us a statement maybe, but we have not heard back from them yet. I still do encourage them, though, to get a hold of us because I do like this argument. I want to bring in Ramon Perez. He's had firsthand experience with the Brookside Police Department. And Leah Nelson is the research director at the Alabama Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. It's a nonprofit devoted to justice and equity. And also with me is Judge Tanya Acker from the very popular legal show Hot Bench. She also hosts her own podcast, The Tanya Acker Show. Welcome to all three of you. Ramon, I'm going to start with you. So tell me about your experience. What happened to you?
Well, it was just a regular day visiting my friends on that side of Brookside, and I saw the cops right in front of me, so I did stop and follow all the instructions according to the law, and next thing I know, as the cop behind me, and I'm questioning myself, why is this stopping me? And he came over and very rude, he started asking the questions and all that kind of stuff, and I tell him, like, I really do want to know why you're stopping me, because I haven't done anything wrong. Well, his attitude didn't went that good. So he was really mad and upset and all that kind of stuff. So told me to get out of the car and I need to provide my documents and all that, which I did at that point. And I tell him, like, I'm really upset in this situation because you are not just doing what is right. And in that point, he was like, well, you look drunk to me. You look drugged to me. And I'm like, sir, I don't consume drugs. I don't drink. I'm good. And he was like, no, well, you're, it seems like your speech is a little bit draggy. And tried to explain as a second language. Sometimes I struggle with it. And obviously,
it sounds like everything just kind of went from small to big to worse, including, you know, threatening to arrest you, arrest the passenger because the passenger doesn't have ID. And then, you know, for good measure, towing your car, which everybody knows how expensive and frustrating that is. And I'll tell you what, Ramon, that's one of many stories that I've heard. Some have ended up in jail for, you know, putting their lights on and being accused of flickering their lights. Okay. So, Tanya, you heard Ramon's story. You heard the stats I was talking about before. More misdemeanors than residents. All of it to the layperson sounds totally nuts. How does it sound to you?
I think that it reminds people that we need to think about what sorts of law enforcement we think are appropriate. I mean, frankly, Ashley, there are communities, for instance, where if people are known to drive dangerously, the residents want police officers to be there issuing tickets if there's a known hazard. What people generally don't want, and I'm going to go out so far as to say, is I think what a lot of what most Americans, like what we are uncomfortable with in this country, is the idea of law enforcement laying in wait, looking for people to do something wrong so they can monetize it. Policing people as a profit center, giving the police authorities, you know, the law enforcement, they have the right to stop us. They have the right to come into our homes. They have great rights, many more rights than the rest of us have. Suggesting to them or suggesting that it's appropriate to use that broad power to raise money is really, really problematic.
So, Tanya or Leah, I want you to weigh in on this. There were some indications of like lines that went all the way out of town hall of people who had to show up with summonses, right? They all had to wait outside, which is weird to start with. They're, you know, 50 to 100 people all waiting in line, obviously all asking each other, "You too, huh?" And they started to, you know, get wise to what was going on. So, Leah, four times the number of officers than the average U.S. town. I'm assuming maybe there's a town out there that needs four times the officers. But isn't that just one giant waving red flag?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people might argue that more officers is better, you get more personal attention. But we have heard firsthand tonight what that personal attention means in Brookside. It means writing more tickets. It means more police officers out there enforcing traffic laws and laws against low-level offenses that can be funneled into the municipal court. And there are really two problems with that. First, it is a bet on crime. If you fund your town, you fund your police department and potentially other town functions using fines and fees collected from low-level offenses, then you are really betting and hoping that people will commit those offenses. The other problem is what happens to the people who accrue those offenses. Obviously, some of them will just pay off their tickets and probably avoid Brookside for the rest of their lives. But a small subset of them are going to be caught in the undertow created by those charges. A lot of my research surrounds what happens to people in Alabama who owe fines and fees over a long period of time. And what I've seen is they end up making desperate choices. They give up basic necessities. They take out payday loans, which in Alabama carry an APR of 456%. Some of them actually go on to commit additional crimes to service their debt to the state. And the reason they make those desperate choices is because 50% of the people that I surveyed in Alabama who owed fines and fees over a long period of time had gone to jail because they weren't able to keep up with their payments.
You know, I could see viewers saying right now, well, gosh, there's, you know, I could see viewers, some viewers saying, gosh, the defund the police movement across the country, this might be the solution, is to up the tickets for people who, you know, if they're going through stop signs, they're going through stop signs. However, Tanya, this is a poor town, okay? They do not have a lot of money. The median income is well below the state average there. And I want to tell you a little bit about what the police were doing on their Facebook page. They were putting the mugshots up of people who hadn't paid their fines yet and saying things like, "Turn yourself in. If we have to come get you, we'll make you famous." But it was either turned private or deleted this week, and I'm wondering if that's really backfired.
Well, I think that you, again, Ashley, have to separate the two different things going on here. As you said at the outset, we're not just talking about, I mean, what's being alleged here is not simply people don't pay. It's not simply a question of folks not paying attention to traffic signs and paying the fine. I mean, what's being alleged is much more serious. It's being alleged that police officers are actually fabricating offenses. You know, what we just heard was that they, you know, police officers often have the right to stop you. And if someone's determined to find something wrong, and if a law enforcement official, as is being alleged, is determined to write a ticket, regardless of the facts, that's really what requires a deeper examination. You know, it's not just you have to pay a ticket if you run a red light. It's whether or not did you really run the light? Is the entire profit center for this town based on trying to find people doing something wrong? I mean, you know, there's a famous cliche. You wake up, go, you leave your house, walk down the street. You may have violated five laws without even knowing it. So I think it's important to look at context and motivations.
I recommend everybody go to AL.com and read that story on police in Alabama and a legal black hole. If you Google legal black hole on AL.com, you'll get to it. It's great. It's a long read. Carve out, you know, a good half hour or an hour. Hey, Leah Nelson, thank you. Ramon Perez and Judge Tanya Acker, good to have you as always. Thanks. Aging in America means nursing homes for many. For many other seniors, live alone with the help from your spouse, maybe. Or maybe with adult kids or paid caregivers. And I want to talk about those adult kids, if I can, for a second. Tonight, there's some brand new research showing that seniors who need help with daily care and activities are more than twice as likely to get that help from their own flesh and blood, their biological kids, than from their stepchildren. That's something that's called the step gap. And it even holds when there's a mix in the family of biological kids and kids by marriage who all kind of grew up together. And here's the sad part. About half of aging parents in both of those groups say that they've got needs that nobody is meeting, either biological or step. I want to get some insights on all of this from two people who know all about this trend. Sarah Patterson is the University of Michigan researcher who spearheaded the study. John Duffy is a clinical psychologist and also a parenting expert. Sarah, I'm going to put some numbers up on the screen. Really surprising. 48.6 is the percentage of older Americans who are getting help from their biological kids. But when that comes to Americans getting help from stepkids, it ain't 48.6. It's 22.5. I don't want to think that the stepkids don't love their, you know, step parents, but it kind of looks that way in the numbers.
Right. Yeah, we were really surprised to see that the gap was so large. We know that older adults today are much more likely to be in step families than they were in previous generations. And so our question really was, because there's more of these step families, are older adults in those step families receiving care from their children, whether they be biological or step? And then do they have unmet care needs that might result because they're not getting care from those children? And what we found is quite striking in terms of the step gap being twice as big, but also it's a little bit surprising that unmet care needs weren't very different between the two groups, which we take to mean that unmet needs are really high among American older adults and that there are more services and adaptations that are needed for them.
Dr. Duffy, you know, there's also a notion that there's a preferred kind of care, that a senior has one particular family member that they would prefer getting the care from, and it is their spouse. Well, everybody knows that's not going to last forever. Are there expectations that everybody just needs to realign as we all get older and realize you're going to have to really think this one through?
Absolutely, especially with an aging population, Ashley. We really got to reconsider how we manage elder care as a population, as a culture, because on the whole, only about 50% of elderly people get the care they need to begin with, whether that's from their spouse, from their children, or from their stepchildren, or some combination thereof. And as people grow older, and there are more step families out there, I think we need to kind of reconfigure how we look at making sure they get their care, and to have that one preferred person take care of you can easily lead to, and I see this all the time in practice, to burnout, to depression, to anxiety, to loneliness for the caretaker themselves.
It's so upsetting to think of that, because I kind of look at step families as not only the norm, but having, you know, been the norm for quite some time. So I'm distressed, Sarah, about the study. But thank you for bringing it to light, and thank you for being here. And Dr. Patterson, thank you as well. Really appreciate Dr. Duffy, I should say, not Dr. Patterson. Sarah Patterson and Dr. Duffy, thank you both for being here. Clearly, I'm getting older, and, you know, names are tricky.